Yes, you're listening to Basgasten, a podcast in which I, Hideroorda, interview nationally and internationally renowned bass players about their career, their gear, and their influences. Basgasten is powered by The Bassist, the magazine for the Dutch and Flemish bass player, and in this episode you'll hear John Stewart of Wilco. He's an amazing bass player and a really nice guy, and he's currently on a world tour with Wilco promoting their new album, Ode to Joy. And I spoke to John prior to their performance in Tivoli Vredenburg in Utrecht, and I'm very curious what he has to say.
That was the boss.
You use and then, flats on your position,
yeah,
right? Yeah.
And jazz, yeah.
I don't think I'm ever gonna change these strings.
No, I know. I have a Mustang with only a second set of strings, 665.
Wow.
And it is like, it's, you know, it's perfect. It's crazy. That in a B12,
right?
It's just like James Jamerson. It's crazy. It's like nuts. It's really, you know, the P I have is like, it's getting better, but it's not magic. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I have a pretty magic jazz bass, but not really. The P bass is coming along, but
is it then the setup or the strings or?
I think it's just the bass and how much it's been played. It's a 70, but it hasn't. I've had it for 15 years now, and I've played it a lot, but I've played a lot of other basses too, so I haven't worn it. You know, I just feel like it just gets better over time.
And did you buy it like new or?
I bought it used, but
yeah, of course,
slightly
used.
But practically new.
But
there's not. It's just right. There's none of that wear. There's still a lacquer on the neck and everything. Right. You know, it's funny. Maybe it was just under a bed for a long time.
Probably. Or someone bought it and played it in church every Sunday, or and that's it.
Vietnam vet. Or on Vietnam, you know, soldier.
Wow. You ready?
Yeah.
All right, great. It's running. So, hey, John.
How you doing?
Yeah,
you doing?
Great to meet you. It's amazing that you wanted to do this.
Oh, thank you for having me. No, this is really, really cool, man.
Yeah.
It's great, you know, two basses and bass talk. I'm into it.
Great.
So thank you.
Yeah. So we're now in Tivoli in Utrecht, where you guys are playing the big stage tonight with Wilco.
Right.
Is this the first time you played on this particular stage?
No. You know, I was reminded that the last time we were here, 2.5 years ago, day after the election, by chance. So Utrecht, unfortunately, is like sort of, it represents the last election, American presidential election to me. But we were all in a bit of a daze, but we did the small room and then the big room.
Right.
We were here two nights. I forget that we actually did two nights here. So we did do the big room once.
Right.
Yeah. So we have done it. It's cool. It's
But now you're back here. Are you like, oh, wait, this is the Donald Trump room? Does it still feel like the Donald Trump room?
It's not. There's not enough gold around. You know,
right.
If there were more gold, it's a little too tastefully appointed.
Right.
You know, I would say.
No, but it doesn't take you back to the moment where you were like, "Oh shit, Donald Trump is our new president."
Yeah.
When you step into this place.
Yeah. I mean, for people of my, you know, of our political persuasion, you know, this is obviously doesn't go for everyone, but there was a. It was an ominous. It was a dark day. I mean, it's pretty much up there with 9/11, frankly.
You know, wow,
it really is. I mean, there's something, just the unknown, the foreboding aspect of it was even kind of weirder. But
yeah,
I just don't connect
Utrecht with.
No, it was, you know, it was funny to be in Europe at that point, just to see the reaction and the, which was, it was both sides, certainly. I saw there were some happy people.
Yeah, I remember waking up and going, what?
Yeah.
Seeing it on the news. I think that was literally my reaction. What?
Yeah.
And so you played Amsterdam a couple of months ago. That was two nights as well.
We did. That's right.
How does the approach to this performance tonight and the Amsterdam performance differ? Are they similar kind of gigs, or do you change set lists? Or, I mean, you played different set lists in Paradiso two nights in a row.
Right, yeah, whole different lists, I think. But that was a good tour to get back into the, because, you know, we had been over 2 years since we had toured at that point. So it was good to get back,
mm-hmm.
just to play the catalog, do a lot of the different stuff. But this tour is featuring a lot of the new record.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's 6-7 songs a night. It's different. And
right.
That really, you know, differentiates a set in a good way. And then finding the things that work well from the catalog with it, you know, to make it work. So for anyone in Amsterdam, it'll be quite a different show.
Right. Great. Well, let me make a new start. Well, in the sense that I asked the same question to every bass player that's a guest, that's my guest. And it's a bit of a weird question now because you're playing one of my basses, but it's still the same question. Which bass are you playing now as we're sitting here?
Well, I'm playing your beautiful 70 precision bass with a neck that I wish was on my bass, frankly.
we're not funny. Switching people.
It's funny to do these interviews and you know, to find an instrument that you rather have than the one you have. But it's a beautiful 70p with a B neck, it looks like, and which is like, feels like a jazz neck to me. It's amazing. And you've got it set up really beautifully. And yeah, but my main bass is a 72. No, it's a 70.
It's a 70 Sunburst, right?
70 Sunburst, and I've had it for a long time. It's like kind of getting more magical over the years, but
right.
It's not. It doesn't have this like sort of real magic, but it's starting over time. So many gigs, I'm really starting to break it in, and it's getting sweeter by the year. So.
So and on tour you're using, I've seen you using multiple basses. You've used a jazz bass, the 65 you told me just before the interview.
Yes.
And you use a Hofner club bass, right?
I do. Yeah. I've been pretty much in this realm for a while. The club play, you know, I play especially Ghost Is Born, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot era. I was playing a lot of Hofner, and I still actually, you know, really vary the basses like in the studio quite a bit, but the Hofner really, it gets used. It's a lot of songs from the catalog,
yeah.
So it's just hard to replicate. You just don't. I have the luxury of being able to bring three basses out, which is so nice. But the jazz, I've had the jazz for about 12 years, and it's a great one. It's been played on.
And how do you decide on which bass to bring? Is it like an instant, you know, it instantly, like, okay, this song needs the Hofner or the Starfire or the Precision, or is it a search within every song or every new album, which sounds you're going to be using?
Well, you know, a lot of times I'm using, like with this record, the Ode to Joy that's about to come out. I'd say the real theme of the whole record is like these really big drum sounds,
right.
These sort of really primal drum sounds, no cymbals. So I kind of had to really match there. Jeff, who played bass, he played bass on a few songs of the record.
Mm-hmm.
I played, I guess I'm in, it was like 70, maybe, I don't know, 40, 60. But so he has a sort of magic P bass that he plays it. I played in Uncle Tupelo going way back, and it's got a beautiful sound. A lot of the really heavy drum stuff, I had to kind of get the biggest sort of bass sound I could get, which is like a Les Paul Signature.
Oh, okay.
Which is what I've played.
That's
for
what
quite
most
a
people
while.
Would know as the Epiphone Jack Cassidy,
yes,
signature now, but it
right.
just it was originally it, released as the Les Paul
73
Signature.
73 and 74, only 500 made really. The Autumn Defense original bass player, Brad Jones, who's a great producer in Nashville, great bass player, had one, and it was always this, he had really big hands, and it was just really huge, you know, great, just massive amounts of low end, but a lot of, you know, just very wide range, basically. Patrick Sansone from the band had gotten one a year before, and I play that quite a bit on Whole Love. And you know, for just it's a really distinctive sound, and something that with this record I had to really sort of get the biggest sound I could really get. Well, not multi-tracking,
right?
You know, although there was a little multi-tracking, but so I don't, you know, I just know I don't want to play that live, even on one song. I don't want to carry it. It's too big. It's too heavy. It's kind of too big for stage. You kind of have to recalibrate the sound and everything for the stage in certain ways. And the Fender basses and the Hofner have just worked for everything over time, you know? And, so I just, you know, we'll give some notes to the front of house guy or whatever. Things need to be, you know, fleshed out even more in these. It's hard. But I was also contemplating a semi hollow, and I might actually still bring one out in the States, but it's hard to align the sounds, you know.
Getting back to a remark you made a little bit earlier about the drums on the new record, my brother, who's a drummer, he heard that on the two singles that are released up until now, no cymbals are being played. Is that a very conscious choice, or was that just something that happened during writing and you were like, hey, this song doesn't need cymbals? Hey, how did that come to be?
Well, I think, you know, I think Jeff has not been a fan of cymbals for a while. I think Glenn had maybe just sort of built on that whole idea of doing, I mean, a lot of microtonal stuff all the way to really, you know, sort of just, you know, crazy multi-tracked big toms. And so it was this idea of, you know, it's a, with a six-piece band, very often it's a frequency, you know, it's a contest, you know, and you want to just clear out as much space as you can. And cymbals are, you know,
cymbals are heavy.
Take a lot of space.
So, yeah.
It's interesting. It's a really cool approach. I think cymbals live, you always have to sort of rethink it and bring it back, because a lot of this material from the record has taken a lot of thought and trial and effort to bring to the stage and make it work in the same way the rest of the material does, at least on it, you know, in a dynamic range.
Yeah. See how it, you know, how it fills a hall
fills
or,
a hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or not, you know, do you want it to, and you know what I mean?
So, yeah, of course.
It's interesting.
So I want to go back a few years and take you back to your beginning. Do you remember the first time you were like, yes, bass, that is what I want to do? Do you remember that some people have this certain moment in their lives where they see one or hear one and go, this is my instrument, this is what I want to do? Do you have a recollection of that moment? Do you have it?
I do. I actually have. I had this sort of really like epiphany of like memory of hearing something, one or two songs that really made me want to play. And one was hearing, being in the back of the car, being a little kid, and hearing Joe Osborne play, Fifth Dimension song, Let the Light Shine In. I'm sorry. Oh my God. We're gonna have to like edit this.
I'm gonna edit that in.
Oh my God. Age of Aquarius. Of like riding in the back of the car and hearing Joe Osborne play the Fifth Dimension song, Age of Aquarius, and with the just incredible bass workout, especially on the final outro. Let the Sunshine In part. And I remember that, just really hearing all this kind of hidden melody in there and really being attracted to it. Right around the same time, hearing Band on the Run, and this is when it came out, so I was 6 or 7.
Wow.
And but hearing it on a jukebox and hearing, you know, like attaching that memory to hearing, you know, Paul on a jazz bass, you know, play that, which I of course didn't know at the time and didn't really know. I just liked the song.
I think some people don't even know that Paul McCartney played a jazz bass at some point.
That's right. I know. Through a long period, all the way up to Tug of War, I think.
Yeah. And I think even the late Beatles records, he played a jazz bass.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I think he had bought it. How was it? Did he buy it in 69, 70? I think he bought it in 70. I'm, you know,
something like that. Yeah.
But that was there was something about all this inventive melody that was kind of under the surface, but still the sort of power of moving air and driving the band. It was really attractive, you know.
So did you tell your parents at age 7, can I play bass?
I was already playing guitar and or at least not at 7, I'm sorry. I really, knowing the bass and knowing I'd like to get into it, picking up the guitar, my parents had a lot of instruments around, so picking up the guitar at about 11 with my sister and sort of like letting her play guitar,
right,
finding a really cheap bass, playing along. But I was doing guitar through that time as well, but certainly when the band started getting together, it was lots of fun to go back and forth, and bass was always a little more fun for me.
And were you a guy that made up his own bass lines, or were you like, okay, now I want to be able to play those Joe Osborne and Paul McCartney kind of stuff? Did you really listen to the records and made sure you could play those bass lines?
Not until later, to be honest. Not until I was at least in my late 20s even, because I was sort of swept up also by, you know, underground rock and punk rock and everything, which wasn't, you know, it's sort of, you know, really demeaned technical prowess in many ways, especially people around my age, which was a real, looking back, it was a massive setback. It really was. It was uncool to be proficient, basically.
Wow, really?
You know? Yeah. It's hard for anyone to ever imagine that.
Yeah.
But it was just this idea of just like, just turning up and just going for it. And that sort of set me back a bit, but then, you know, in my later 20s, I started to really appreciate. I mean, I knew a lot of these players, and the heroes were already there, like, you know, Jamerson and Joe Osborne by that time, I'm sure. But yeah, it was. But sitting down and learning the parts was a little bit later.
That's funny that you named Joe Osborne. I mean, many people would know James Jamerson from the Motown records, but Joe Osborne is maybe a bit of a more unknown player to many bassists. I mean, many people on the Wrecking Crew, and then, of course, Carole Kay.
Mm-hmm.
But then Joe Osborne is there, and I think many people just know his name by the signature bass he had at Lakeland.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, he was just...
How did you find out about Joe Osborne? Because in that period, it wasn't really known who those guys were in the on those, like, the Capitol records from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. How did you find out about Joe Osborne?
I remember talking to a friend about Age of Aquarius, actually, and then finding finding out his story. In fact, he was from Louisiana, which is where I'm from, but he had this incredible kind of art career playing with Ricky Nelson and Johnny Rivers early on, and it was just little pieces started to come together, and then, of course, when, you know, online, I was able to like sort of piece it together when the internet emerged, basically. But Dan Lakin was a big, I mean, I met him through Dan Lakin, and he was a big, you know, I mean, Dan just had put together like a 4-CD history of Joe Osborne, and you know, parts, you know, just. You know, I didn't know about the Mamas and the Papas and California Dreamin' and things like that. Just like, wow. So he's just there on the, and it culminated with me. I actually interviewed him before his death. I tried to do a written story and a couple of publications, and they didn't get accepted. But I have a really great interview with him, later on, which is really great. A lot of great stories.
And do you remember your favorite bass line by Joe Osborne, which is? If someone's listening who doesn't really know who Joe Osborne is, which song or which album do they have to check out?
I guess I would say Only Living Boy in New York off Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel. And I mean, he played just the ability to, well, just playing on that record, just the band, Nectel, Hal Blaine, and Joe Osborne, like, what a incredible. Holy shit. I mean, Larry Nectel, amazing bassist in his own right.
Yeah.
You know, played on a lot of Doors, played on the Doors' first album. Tons of bass credits, but just such a beautiful piano player, too. Just incredible. Yeah. So that, that's a real, you know, that whole record, just the feel of it. It's yeah. just so, so great.
So, and then after you've figured out who Paul McCartney and Joe Osborne were, are there current bass players that you're like, okay, I'm gonna, if a record is released with that particular bass player on it, I'm gonna check it out. Are there people you're really watching at the moment?
Oh, at the moment, I've always, actually younger guys, it's really, I really like the bass playing on that Whitney record. I don't know if you heard the Whitney band called Whitney out of Chicago.
No.
That was really nice bass playing, and I cannot tell you who actually did it, I'm saying sadly. So things catch my ear. I mean, I think young rockers are incredible. I mean, I just hear things left and right that sound so good and such good proficiency. A lot of guys my age I really like Justin from Beck's band. Mm-hmm. I ended up
also
getting one of his Mustangs.
A great signature Mustang.
Really, it's a great bass. It's great, and I've always admired his playing. Gus he was playing with Roger Waters recently. Mm-hmm. He's a really great player. Google's last name, but
yeah, no problem.
But yeah, it's but yeah, it's just so many young players that are killer. But that Whitney record really had a really nice bass sound and sensibility.
A band called Whitney, or is it Whitney. Just called Whitney? Yeah,
Whitney, mm-hmm.
like Whitney Houston, but then a bit different. I asked on Facebook and on my Instagram account if someone has a question for you, and a very good friend of mine called Alert, he said, I have some questions. And the first one is, together with Jeff, you've been with Wilco since the start. How do you feel the band has changed over time, and has playing with different band members changed the way you play in Wilco?
That's a good question, and it's really true. Like the different incarnations of the band, especially when it was really unsettled, when we were, really around, really started as a four-piece. Jay Bennett came on in the first tour of the record, and then that period of being there in Summer Teeth, like having kind of a five-piece with Bob Egan or Leroy Bach as the fifth guy, either pedal steel or keyboard, the band got really big sounding. And then it's sort of for Yankee when Jay left, it got really, all of a sudden it was, everything felt really naked. So that was a good example of sort of trying to expand, trying to not not stay in your lane so much and just try to turn up and play a P bass or play a loud bass and sort of just cover the...
Yeah, so cover, you make a bigger sound, but then...
Yeah, because
you
we're
also
playing...
find yourself making more melodic bass lines, like, okay, now I have some room, I can fill up the space that we have now in this new sound?
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. The being there and Summer Teeth were more sort of dense productions when Glenn came in the band, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, there was a real minimal sort of... it was like this kind of look to all sorts of more minimal side of music, krautrock, other things, lots of space and lots of just angular, mm-hmm. angular sort of approach to everything. And that was really representative of that. And just very, but I don't know, from a musical standpoint, I've always been able to we've always been able to put touchstones onto it in terms of, okay, this is like a, let's think of like Gang of Four. Let's think of, mm-hmm. and you can, I think we've always been able to maybe make our expression kind of work with what's going on in it,
Now you're a six piece.
We're a six piece, yeah.
With three guitar players and then a keyboard player and you.
It's Pat goes from keyboards to guitar.
Oh, right.
And
so, but how do you? You play quite melodically. At times, mm-hmm. like rhythmically, most of the times quite like uncomplicated.
Mm-hmm.
But then melodically, you kind of wave through chords. How do you arrange that with so many harmony going on everywhere? Do you make sure you're not in the way of everybody?
It's that's really basically that's been my job for the last, you know, 15 years with this band is and a lot of it is determined by how the song is recorded. Mm-hmm. If the drums and bass get recorded, you know, Wilco the album, no, excuse me, Whole Love was a good example of kind of doing record, you know, basically basic tracks, acoustic bass and drums. So a lot more room, a lot more melodic, a lot, you know, using more overdriven sounds. Sky Blue Sky, much of smaller, you know, much more of a dense palette going on harmonically everywhere, and to the point where I'm slinking around, but basically, you know, it's just interplay between the guitar and the bass, but not much harmonic exploration there, really, you know, more of a feel thing. And because so much atmosphere between Pat and Nels, like guitar, keyboards and guitar, you know, they sort of bookended the band on this atmospheric level. Yeah. So almost everything is sort of being touched on, or, you know.
But is it also a sound kind of thing? Because you said earlier about the frequencies being, you know, clashy. And I mean, we have two guitar players and we're still like, whoa, this is a bit too much mid-high. And do you also adjust your sound to that? Like, you have this, I mean, you flat wound strings and everything, and a vintage precision bass or a Hofner or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that also a stylistic choice, as in, if I have this muffled sound, I won't be in the way of anybody?
Yeah, definitely. Thinking, like, as the track is evolving, or it really, in the last two records, a lot of the, it's been a lot more overdubbing, a lot less, like, sort of, so things are sort of, aspects are there to begin with, but there's still a lot of trying out of basses.
Yeah.
You know, just having four or five basses and just playing along with it, waiting for magic to happen, basically. But I'd say those records where we were really arranging guitars together, mostly Sky Blue Sky, really, that was, there's definitely an X factor in terms of what can happen in those,
The guitar parts really connect and intertwine with what they're doing rhythmically, and
they listen. So, you know,
just that was really arranged before recording,
kind of sitting down as we're doing it, but, you know, just, you know, evolving with takes, Beatles style or whatever, like, but, you know, to have, like, sort of musicians like that, but are such good listeners as well, you know, and they play off of what you're doing, and that's really the, you know, the dream, you know.
Keep your ears open.
Yeah, I mean, especially people like Nels and like Pat, who are, you know, pretty serious, you know, have a pretty serious ability to kind of do anything. So yeah. It's nice.
It's nice is an understatement. Allard, my friend, he also asked, like, it's a Kill Your Darlings question, but he said, do you have a favorite Wilco record?
I think Being There was sort of, has always been sort of really important, because it was this sort of, you know, just given what was happening at the time with the band, and, you know, Tupelo had broken up, we had made our record, Sunvolt made this really kind of, record that really made waves. Mm-hmm. And we sort of had this, you know, Jeff was really just, you know, it was a little bit, not desperation, but it was a little bit of abandon, you know, and it just sounded like people having a great time.
Yeah.
You know, the session just felt great, even in the face of, like, well, I don't know if we're going to be able to make another record after this.
Yeah.
It just had a certain level of abandon and humor that.
Do you still listen to that record?
I had to listen to it.
I
was forced to at gunpoint. No, I'm just kidding. I hear Wilco all the time in stores, basically. Yeah.
And then you run out to Home Depot. You're like, oh no, that's me.
Yeah. But I did hear, we went back and played. Did we play the whole record? I forget it, but I had to go back and study this record, the tracks, they sound great to me. There was a certain fidelity on the first two records. It was really kind of cool. The first record mixed by a guy named Richard Dodd, who had just mixed Wildflowers by Tom Petty. Same, it really has a lot of the same sounds.
Yeah.
It was like one project to the next, and it was snare drum and vocal, you know, kind of really cool kind of parody with that record. And then Being There was done at CRC. It was like a big, you know, serious analog studio, like
right.
doing slave reels, like 48 tracks of analog. And it sounds cool.
It sounds like a wet dream for every vintage style musician.
I know, to be able to record on tape now is just like such a luxury, you know.
Yeah.
But then by the time we got into Summer Teeth, Pro Tools was creeping in, and we were going back and forth, Pro Tools to analog, and that's ironically what gave it that weird, just slightly off sound to the whole record, you know. And it was bit sample rates and things, I think, that weren't exactly
right.
You know, there's just some mojo, you know, of doing that in that era when you're running like OS9, you know, Pro Tools.
Do you have a preference now for being with Pro Tools or analog or a combination of both?
I got to record. I've been playing with Ray LaMontagne a good bit, bass, which has been fun in a duo setting.
Wow!
And I play a Mustang with it, and play short scale bass, just to like less overtones and everything. But I recorded his record with him, and he had it's all tape and just like. Super fun and incredible, you know, just really no more than four takes, and then, you know, and then maybe move on and come back, you know, so you're not
never to capture the live of kind of feel.
Yeah, it was lovely. A couple guys from My Morning Jacket on that, and really, really fun. That was his last record, which is called It's just a last record. I toured.
We're gonna look it up now.
Yeah. Oh my god. You can have your editing work.
I'm a great editor. I'm gonna edit all this out. No, I'm not. You're talking about Such a Simple Thing. No, Part of the Light.
Part of the Light.
Yeah, Such a Simple Thing is the single of that record.
Yeah, and that's got a great, the Part of the Light record with Ray LaMontagne it's really great analog sound and it feels like a luxury to record on tape.
So do you do that with Wilco, or do you?
We have a machine, but we're kind of in the mode of recording on, you know, there's so many things actually. Jeff generally has many, many songs in the pipeline.
Right.
So it's just too hard to go back on tape to different ones.
Because when you're recording Pro Tools, you can just go, we're not using that. And when you're recording on tape, you have it.
Yeah, exactly.
So it feels like you got to do something with it.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, it's almost like an effect now. You know, tape, it's almost like a, you know, and we have the ability to run through the tape machine too onto tape and stuff. So it's we get that effect. And Tom Schick and has been the house engineer for a long time at the loft now, like 5 years. So he's the sounds are really dialed in.
So just press record and go.
Yeah.
More or less. Yeah.
Pretty much everything's ready to go.
Awesome.
It's really the place has had so many, it's been around since 98, and we've had so many incarnations where the shit was broken and kind of like it was just not, you know, and it's realized now. I mean, it's a commercial room, you know.
Right.
A lot of people record there now.
So going back to the bassist you were checking out, so you were talking about Joe Osborne and Paul McCartney being your first conscious influences on what you were playing and how you were playing. And when you were discovering those kind of guys, where did you end up? Where did your influential path go, so to say?
It's really funny because Paul, Paul was always someone to aspire to. I just could never have that amount of composition and his ability to just compose something like that that has the nuance, that has the power, the drive, you know, and still the ability. It's just it's just too much, you know, when you know, I have like learned a lot of the lines, you know, I'll learn something every year at some point and then forget it and go back and like, and, but, so, I think it was mainly like Southern, like Joe Osborne, guys that were kind of white guys that were trying to emulate Motown guys like David Hood from the Muscle Shoals.
Oh, of course, yeah, from the Swampers. Yeah.
Yeah. And Tommy Cogbill from the American Recording Service band from Memphis, who did Dusty in Memphis.
Who did
Suspicious Minds and everything. And he to me, that guy, he's like Joe. I mean, he's the guy that, you know, it's just rolling kind of lines, like soulful rolling lines, just with kind of going off at the end of the song, you know.
It's cool really way. Great that you're mentioning all these names. For most people, they might sound like, who are those guys? I mean, I know the Swampers. I've seen a documentary about the Muscle Shoals studio. Did you see it?
I did.
It's an amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Amazing,
yeah. I spent a lot of time there. It's a great. It's a magic town.
Is it as magic as they say?
It is. It's like physically beautiful, and it just has a feel. You know, it's like this little chunk of Nashville that just is down there. You know, just with these. You know, David Hood is still around. You know, I mean, a lot of the guys are still.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, Rick only died like last year, right?
Yeah.
And Jimmy Johnson just died, actually, who was, you know, who was. He really broke off and started started the new studio. But you know that it's all alive and well.
Yeah.
You know,
and it still feels magical to be in Muscle Shoals.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. You have to look for things. You know. Yeah. You have to go to the studios. But you can now. They've redone. You know the spot where the Stones recorded and Paul Simon the second incarnation, second studio of the Swampers, and Fame is still there, which is just incredible. So,
right,
yeah, it's amazing.
I have to go to Alabama.
Oh, you know, you do. It's a fun. You can mix it in with a Mississippi Delta drive too. That is like super soul. It's fun.
I go back to the roots
of it all,
of everything, man.
Right, it's so true.
Yeah, I have to get back to Paul McCartney because I mean I can hear in your playing that he's a great influence, like the sound and the playing a Hofner bass.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular bass line of Paul that you could practically basically use as a soundcheck lick or?
Oh.
Is there a go to Paul McCartney bass line for you?
Oh my God.
I mean, for me it will always remain that.
Oh, nice. Yes, yeah.
All the
playing
time.
In third position.
Of
absolutely. It's funny because I've always been a fan, but I've just had this like super deep, just going back to the early stuff. Beatles for Sale has emerged to me as being just this. You know, it gets looked down upon, but it's actually just like the pre-Rubber Soul, which is so great. It's also their absolute affirmation of being like an Everly Brothers, like, you know, the Everly Brothers love what a lot of people call country and Western, but just this like No Reply. I'd say the bridge of No Reply is one of those things where it's all simple. It's a little bossa thing in the verse, in the verses, just, you know, getting this bossa and then ripping into this, that like what is really one of the great Beatles moments, the middle, you know, the middle 16 of No Reply.
I have to admit, the Beatles for Sale is not a record that's in. Like
on
in
your
front
radar.
Of my,
yeah.
No.
I know. It's one of those things. It's just like it's just such a universe of songs and what they were doing to create.
Oh, that's the opener.
Yeah.
Opening track. Let me see if this works. This happened once. Oh yeah, that one, of course.
Sure. Back into your door, no reply. They said it wasn't you, but I saw you peep through your window. I saw the light. I know that you saw
me as I looked up to see your face. I tried to telephone, they said you were not home. That's a lie, 'cause I know where you've been.
Let me skip to the middle 16, but it might be the most underrated Beatles record.
I think so. And like going down, this troika of Every Little Thing, I Don't Want to Spoil the Party, and What You're Doing, great bass line, and What You're Doing. That's a really underrated Paul song.
Man, the drum sound is great.
Oh, it's amazing. And this song also kind of created the Birds.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's the 12 string sound.
Yeah.
Look what you're doing. I'm feeling blue
very
and
bass
lonely.
Light though, not mixed loud.
To ask of you what you're doing to me. You got me running. And
they did it in about 4 days too. That's
the whole record.
Yeah. It was like the 8 original songs on that are incredible. You know, I mean, the fact that, and you know, they had to flesh it out with Kansas City, and but they, you know, amazing. Babies in Black. I mean, all the original songs on that are incredible.
Wow. It's really weird that when I think about Paul McCartney bass lines, I immediately think of, you know, the later, the later stuff, the Sgt.
Like,
Pepper
especially
stuff.
Especially Sgt. Pepper. Yeah. I mean, the story of him coming in late night after the sessions and redoing the bass himself, you know. Yeah, that was, I mean, that it's certainly...
So many great stories.
Yeah, incredible. And, you know, and the Rickenbacker and everything.
Yeah. I heard did you hear the new tapes from the Beatles where John was trying to record a new Christmas album? Everybody knows that the Beatles were fighting during the Abbey Road sessions.
Right.
And now new tapes have surfaced where it seems that John is trying to convince the other Beatles to record another record.
Wow.
In late 69.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. Are they online?
I don't know if they're online. They're gonna be released, but a couple of like Beatles aficionados have already heard them.
Nice, wow.
And I'm like, whoa, that's really weird. It's rewriting everything we knew about the end of the Beatles.
Right.
Because everyone thought, you know, John blew up the band and
Well, I mean, really Paul. That was a funny thing, was it at the Alan Klein the signing.
Yeah.
Which was September whatever, it was like 2 days ago in Beatles history. And Paul saying you want to leave. I mean, John saying you want to leave the group, but then Paul, you know, announcing it to the press first.
Right.
You know, which was a great story in a lot of ways. Yeah, yeah.
But then I heard on the radio that John Lennon hated George Harrison's song so much, he doesn't play on any George Harrison songs.
Oh, ever?
Ever.
Well, have you heard the conversation?
If I remember correctly.
Well, I mean, I Me Mine is like a big story for sure of Lennon hating that song.
Oh wow,
that's a big one, and there's a lot of that in Let It Be.
Yeah,
but I just heard the George Rubber Soul track. Shit, I'm sorry.
No problem. Let's see who finds it first. There you go. That's Norwegian Wood.
No, the George tune. What Goes On, right? Ringo. I'm sorry. Oh shit.
Of course that's Ringo.
Oh my god.
I will
think for yourself, song. Right?
Ah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, with the mate fuzz bass. Oh my god.
This one. Yep.
They have you heard the it was the backing track was recorded, but then they did a whole session for vocal for that, and it was really, it's actually one of the loveliest sort of lighthearted moments. But them working on the George song, but John is really not detached, but like George is extremely patient with him.
Yeah,
you know, it's really interesting. I could see how things would devolved from there because he wasn't putting everything into it. You know, I think George was always just like the little brother. It was just, you know, to him.
Yeah, it might be the most underrated Beatle.
Yeah. Oh, God. Totally.
I mean, people go like, yeah, John and Paul. Yeah. And then Ringo. God. Yeah, he was the drummer.
Oh, man. Ringo was, I mean, you go on record, like George Martin has gone on record many times saying that Ringo made the least amount of mistakes all through the career of the band. Yeah. Like his mind on arrangements and everything, he was completely, you know, I will not stand for any Ringo hate whatsoever.
I saw a video of him playing a couple of months ago. I was like, it sounds exactly the same as it did 50 years ago. He can still do it.
It's amazing. He was a star before the others. You know, they were, you know, he was the go-to guy.
I have another question from a friend of mine, who's also a bass player and a big Wilco fan as it is. And he was asking, how do you get the palm muted sound like on The Whole Love? Do you have any advice? Do you just use a mute or?
I've used a sponge a lot, but also Hofner. I use the heel of the bass quite a bit.
Like the classic palm muting technique.
Yeah, and it's probably more that than the sponge.
Right.
Like Jim O'Rourke was he was a big advocate for the sponge, and the couple of bass six tracks that I've tried worked really well with it. You know, that he would do that with Stereolab. I think we were trying to get that, remember that?
Do you have a bass six sound?
I don't actually own one right now. You know, Jeff has one,
of course.
Jeff usually has, he'll have whatever you need.
And
you,
on the new new single, Everyone Hides, you can be seen playing a Guild Starfire bass. Is that yours?
That's mine. That's an old, that goes back to being there, the photo of being in the sleeve of being there. I'm playing that bass too. So that was like, that was like the third bass.
Is that also your bass you used recording it?
Yeah, I used the Starfire a ton on being there, like Sunken Treasure.
Yeah, but also on the new single.
Oh, you know, no, I was using.
Or it's just
I was
because
using,
it looks good.
Yeah, it was the video. It was last minute. We were like, all right, our gear was already gone. A lot of our gear was already in Europe. So it's like, you know, I wanted to find a red guitar, but I couldn't. I wanted to find something cool looking, but it's pretty cool looking bass.
It's a very cool looking bass.
Grabbed it. Yeah.
So we just we need a bass.
I know.
Here's one.
That's true. There's no lack of cool looking guitars at the loft. That's for sure.
Yeah. How many basses were used on the new record?
I had, let's see. So the signature, probably the most. Jeff,
so that's
the Gibson Les Paul signature.
Oh yeah, of course.
Jeff's P bass on a lot of tracks, songs that he played on, were that. Like Hofner on one track, Guild on two tracks, actually. Wow. Yeah, it's a really big, cool sound. Sounds so good with toms and just, you know, so woody, that wood bridge. And let's see, some other, messed around with a Senator.
Oh yeah, that's the huge hollow body.
The huge hollow body, but more thin. Yeah, and that was cool. The Fender Jazz and the Lakeland Jazz.
The Lakeland Jazz.
Joe Osborne owned the bass actually.
Oh wow.
And he didn't. I got the bass from him because he didn't want a pink bass. It's not really pink. It's more like.
It's pinkish.
It's pinkish, but too pink for him. He's like, I don't want, you know, he had it for a while, and I was like, sure, I'll.
Yeah.
Anything, I'm confident in my masculinity. And
I'll play you pink bass. Yeah, of course.
To have this free bass. And also, you know, it was like golden era Lakeland stuff for sure.
Right.
You know, that's a pretty magic newer bass. It sounds great in a just sounds great in a big rock song. Yeah.
So how is that for you that Jeff plays a lot of bass on the records? I mean, I can imagine you going, wait a minute, I'm the bass player. What are you doing? I mean, I can imagine it's been like that for a long time, but...
Yeah. It's really more recent. He was always, first of all, I always loved his bass playing in Uncle Tupelo. You know, I was, you know, big, I really, really enjoyed it. But it's starting, and there would be the occasional tracks he would play on, like Heavy Metal Drummer, he played on that, because he just created the track with an engineer, really. It was like a real solo effort. But, you know, pretty much, you know, everything else had been me until Star Wars, or especially Schmilko. There was some stuff. He's gotten a lot more. The way he likes to write now is just to flesh out demos completely. He's in the studio every day, and when we're off tour, and so he'll get together with his son, put demos together, and always fill in the bass. And when he has something that he just really can't part with, you know, he probably played two songs on the record, but I played maybe one or two of his lines almost verbatim. There's something that he can't really,
so it's,
he can't get
if
away
he can't
from.
Part from the yeah. from bass line, and, he'll do it
and,
himself.
And you know, and but there will definitely you know, I try to incorporate some aspect of my personality to them.
And then live,
it all morphs in this way. And, you know, and it's interesting. So it's kind of an interesting way to work that way.
Yeah.
Because it does, you know, and a lot of times he does, since it's basically an acoustic track that exists, he'll do a lot. He'll take up a lot more space harmonically.
Right.
You know? So it's like something that doesn't really happen that often when we record together. Mm-hmm. So, it's interesting. I think it's really not a bad process, you know, but
then on your bass lines, does he give you some idea of this is what I'd like to hear because I wrote this and this and blah, 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 or do you get,
sometimes on the stuff that he can't part with, it'll be that kind of thing.
Like, yeah.
I just has to be there, but the rest of the stuff, not really, just like what, you know,
do what you do best.
Yeah. And it kind of, there's just with all of us, there's so much of each other and our playing too. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. Like a couple of things that he plays, I'm like, God, that's just something that I would have done, or, you know, or that maybe it was influenced by me or some weird way. Cause I've certainly been influenced, his acoustic playing and his bass playing have influenced me. So it's this weird DNA thing now.
Working together for so many years.
Yeah.
Of course you're going to have some influences to each other, of course.
Yeah, for sure. That's kind of fun.
And you also sing backing vocals?
I do, yeah.
Was that a natural thing, or is it something you really wanted to do?
I was a front man of a band for a long time, like early growing up. I was bass and guitar, and so I was like lead singer in bands forever, including Hilltops, a band that when I met Jeff, indie rock band that we toured together, and, you know, we're, you know, friends. And later I joined as a side man. I was never really a side man before that. And so it was, and there was one distinctive, I remember I was playing a lot of guitar in those days, some bass, but there was one cover band that I just for fun sort of got in. It was like kind of a country rock, kind of a Birds kind of cover band. Played around the time of the early of Tupelo and early Wilco, and that was like great exercise for me, just singing and playing bass at the same time, lead comfortably, because I've done it before, but it was like a lot of that was like real Wilco DNA, a lot of, you know, just basically like mid-period Birds and stuff, you know. So but you know, singing was always harder, of course, with bass and singing lead and everything. But I'd done it from pretty early age, and joined Wilco, and Jeff. I was writing songs for the first album. Only one of them appeared on the record.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Jeff, I just didn't. I was living in a separate town. I kind of had an opportunity that I could have. I should have been there more. You know, his work ethic was a lot better than mine at that point. And so yeah, I was singing lead. I mean, early in the band. Yeah. So
you're used to
it. He was already. He had been in a partnership for a long time at that point, and obviously emerged as a great songwriter. So he took all the songs.
Yeah.
Which is. A lot of people are happy about.
Wow, that's a great way to
end. Yeah, not a bad.
Many people are happy with that. We're not going to tell who isn't.
Yeah.
John, I really want to thank you so much for being my guest and playing my bass.
Oh my God, it's a pleasure. And, it's a great conversation, Eddie. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it was fun.
Have fun tonight.
And, thank you.
Maybe we'll see you downstairs.
Hope to.
Great, thanks. You heard the interview I had with John Stewart of Wilco. And did you like Basgasten? Check out my Facebook page. Check out all the other episodes of Basgasten. And leave a review on iTunes so people can find the podcast. Basgasten is powered by The Bassist Magazine. And in 2 weeks' time, you'll hear Jan Teertstra.
Ik speel de bas. Dat was de bas.